I will be talking about approximations to ground states of gapped Hamiltonians. And in there is also like K local, which is something that you guys will probably like. So it will be like Hamiltonians with local interactions and a spectral gap. So why is this interesting, first of all? So how many of you know Matt Hastings? Just raise your hand. Good. Okay, he's done some pretty good research. He's now at Microsoft Research Station Q here. And I think it was like a couple of years ago, he came up with a proof that in one dimension you have an area law, you know, for ground states of gapped Hamiltonians. And so I looked at the paper and I saw in one of the lemmas he used that he was trying to approximate the ground state of, you know, these Hamiltonians that have local interactions and a gap. And I was wondering if I could just, you know, find a generalization in higher dimensions of this lemma, then maybe I could just show the area law for like, you know, any dimension, right? As far as these Hamiltonians are concerned. It turns out that it's not that simple. I will actually show you a generalization. You know, I will show you a theorem that shows, you know, these ground states have a nice representation, but it is not enough to show an area law. And this is why I just, 5 minutes ago, I changed the title of the talk again to approximating ground states of gap Hamiltonians, which you will see on Wikispace too, and there is no entanglement. Even though this was part of my thesis, where I was trying unsuccessfully to apply this to an area law in higher dimensions, but at least you can see why it fails if you're interested in the area law. So this quote I came up with, I guess, you know, found from George Cantor, because I want you guys to ask questions. There will be a lot of stuff that you see, but you will not believe. So I'll try to make sure that this doesn't happen too often. But I guess we can start with a setup. I have a picture here, I guess everyone can see. So the ground states we'll be looking at will be on systems that have, let's say, are in ZD, okay, or some like, you know, power of like Z. So it's, you know, you're on the lattice in two or three or whatever dimensions, and you take like a region of that lattice, you consider it as being your volume, the whole like, you know, thing, and then you have sites inside there, okay? And on each side we'll have, as I will write down, certain spins or like qubits, qdits, whatever you want your system to be. Each side will have a Hilbert space associated with it that is finite dimensional. And what we're interested in is the ground state of certain Hamiltonians that have interactions defined among these sites. So they have a local range, as I will be writing down, and they also have a spectral gap, which means that they have an energy gap between the ground state energy and the first excited energy. There will also be Hamiltonians that have a unique ground state. So we can really like talk about it specifically. So
don't know degeneracy.
No degeneracy, yes. Unique ground state with a spectral gap. That's right. So let's see here. I will write down, actually, right now, a little more about the space. So let's just call this big space. It's going to be V, and it's going to be, let's say, isomorphic Z to the N for some N, okay? Even though in the paper we can assume like metric spaces in more generality that have some topological structure. But we will say that for each, let's take like a site x in here, okay, little x. For each one of them, we will associate it with it a Hilbert space, h sub x. Let's say that the dimension, we will call the dimension of this Hilbert space just n sub x. This is just for notational reasons. And the matrices that are n by n sub x by n sub x will just denote like these, they're complex matrices. And we will say that the algebra of observables on a subset x of V is going to be the tensor product for all x in big X of like these, you know, matrices, okay? This is a usual setup, you know, when you try to talk about observables. And again, like, you know, this, this notation means that you can consider this algebra of observables on X as being like somehow embedded in whole V, okay? Just by saying that this is like x, tensor the identity on the complement. Okay, so it will have a trivial support outside of the set x, and that's how we denote that, right? And when we talk about support, we will talk about that minimal set on which you have some non-trivial action of your operators, you know, in that algebra of observables. And this will be important, as we, I guess we'll see later on. So let me actually state the theorem, and then I will explain, you know, many of the parts that go into the theorem. So here, this is the theorem on the approximation. So we have a product of three operators, which I will call P sub x boundary of 3L, P sub chi and P sub chi complement, minus the projection to the unique ground state is going to be less than or equal to some constant that depends on two other constants, the range of interactions and the strength of interactions. The number of elements in the boundary of this set chi squared, and then these little like things here that I will explain now. This is the important part right here, the exponential decay with some correlation length. And we have, those are a lot of constants, but they will all become clear hopefully soon. So let's just say, okay, we have okay, so you should be sufficiently scared by now because there's a lot of stuff in there that I haven't explained yet. But first of all, what is this L? This L that comes in here and also like appears here and here and kind of gives you like the strength of the approximation. This L is exactly like the thickness of this boundary here, okay? The picture that I've drawn here, the boundary has thickness L, right? This operator is going to be supported on something that looks like this, but three times L. All right, these operators here, which are actually going to turn out to be projections, this one and this one, are supported again on chi and chi complement. So they actually have a tensor product structure when you look at them like this. And chi is like everything inside this purple, like, you know, part here, right? And chi complement is everything outside. So they partition the space, right? Chi complement can be just thought of as this part here. So what does this really say? It says that the ground state, projection onto the ground state of this Hamiltonian we're interested in, can be decomposed as a product of three operators. Okay. Now, these operators have the following properties. This is in the algebra of observables with support on chi, as has been defined in there. The same thing for this guy here. And finally, this other like weirder operator, which is not actually a projection as far as I know so far. I can't show that this can be made into a projection, but it's not important. This is in here. And we have that the norm of this operator is bounded above by 1. Okay. This starts becoming, I guess, a little bit more clear what these approximation operators are, right? Now, again, as I was saying before, if you look at these two things, they really look like projections, you know, a tensor product of two projections. They're not rank one projections, unfortunately. Otherwise, I guess we could get an area law for higher dimensions, but they're still projections, right? And we will see where they come from. So what else is it that remains? Okay, this is just a constant that depends on R and J, and let me just define now what these R and J are. So the Hamiltonian, which I should have done some time ago, which we call like H on the volume of V, V is the whole thing, is the sum of these weird pi interactions where Z are subsets of V And what do we have on these interactions? Okay, these interactions are kind of like mathematical objects that take you from subsets of your volume onto just some local Hamiltonian. Okay, you can think of it as just something local. But what do we mean by that? That if the diameter of the set Z is greater than R, this is going to imply this is zero. Okay. So they only have interactions among, like, you know, our nearest neighbors.
What's chi 3L?
I was going to go and explain that even more, yes. I talked a little bit about that, but, you know, we'll actually define it exactly. This region overlaps, like, you know, 3L with this and this. On the inside with this and on the outside with this.
So
yes?
I haven't put any quantifiers in here, but the way I'm reading it, it says there exists three P's such that.
Yeah, exactly. It means exactly that. There exists this P that satisfies this P that satisfies that, and this other one. Exactly. Yes.
Sure.
So,
yes. Does that mean that if I chose any compact region for my interior, that I could always do this?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the point, that for any chi, right, this is like, you know, one of our parameters. For any chi, for any region, compact region, convex also, let's say, because this is important later on, you can always create these regions. Okay, this is already given for you, and this one, once you've chosen what it is. This one, let me just define it right now. S in V, such that the distance between S and the boundary of chi is less than 3L. And I think that's what it means, yes. And the boundary of chi, I mean, it's just, you know, all the elements that are exactly like right here on that purple line. Okay. Yes.
You don't want to do what Matt did and make nearest neighbor interactions and just let the number, you know, coordinates, qubits or qubits mm-hmm. into larger blocks or something. It's not a simplification that helps you, or that's valid in high dimensions.
You mean like if I took R to be equal to 2?
Right. By just putting qubits together or something.
No, you still have to worry about the Lie-Bronson bounds work. You mean like you just take the one-dimensional result and make it higher dimensional by doing the simplification? Or just saying that why am I using R instead of 2 there?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, exactly. R could be equal to 2, just we do it explicitly. So make it easier for people if they want to say, okay, what if R is actually growing somehow with, you know, the volume? So this would be explicit there, the bounds. Okay. So does this make a little more sense now? Yes, Jeff.
So in terms of this picture,
yes.
Chi is what's inside the purple circle?
Chi is what inside the purple circle, yes.
Chi complement is outside, and then this yellow shaded region is what the chi boundary 3L is, right?
It's actually the chi boundary 1L. But if I made this 3L, I wrote 3L here and here, that'll be that, yes. As we will see, like through the proof, it's going to be expanding as we're going, but I just drew a representative like boundary shell, so.
Can you explain what is this HV is equal to something?
So yes, so I was going to be writing a little more about these interactions, but I guess this was kind of important. So these interactions, first of all, have finite range R, right? And they also satisfy this finite strength condition that say that if we take the maximum over any site in the volume, right, of all the interactions, and the norms of the interactions that contain this site, and we just write it like this, then this is less than or equal to some constant J, uniform constant J, right? That's something usual, I guess, in these cases. So what else do we have here? I don't want to forget. I was also going to be writing stuff up as I hear questions too, so. But it seems so far we're doing okay. Yes?
What's the assumption on the gap?
Yes, actually, I was about to write that right now. Perfect. So the assumption on the gap is the following. That's why I also gave you notes, so I don't have to write everything nicely here, you know. The assumption on the gap is, and I will go here to write that. So the assumption on the gap is that there exists a unique ground state psi naught such that HV. I guess we could even assume, because later on it's going to be useful, but it doesn't have to be, that this is like zero ground state. We can move it. But that there is a gap so that and P naught is equal to I know. And HV has spectral gap. Okay. Now, whenever you hear, like, you know, that the Hamiltonian has a spectral gap, like gamma greater than zero, okay, I mean, if this is unique, this should always be the case for finite volumes, right? But what we mean really here is that as V is extended to larger and larger, like linear scales, that this is still true. This depends on the volume, let's say, but it's still there is some like uniform lower bound gamma for which this is the case. So
gamma has nothing to do with, let's say, volume.
No, exactly. You need that. You know, otherwise, you know, it's, as you can see from here, it's going to be messing things up. I mean, you could still get some bound, even if this is changing, but you don't really want to, like, close the gap at some point. So.
Can you give an example of such a Hamiltonian?
Of any Hamiltonian that has, I guess, translational and invariant Hamiltonians, or, like, you know, maybe something frustration-free, or things that, like, for you can show for small volumes that it works, and then every time you continue, like, you know, the gap remains open. Has been proven.
Any translation
of invariant Hamiltonians? No. No, just some translation invariant Hamiltonians. You can show that. Frustration-free systems, I was thinking. You know, frustration-free systems have certain properties have been proven by Nachtigallen and others that if you start, like, you know, with frustration-free Hamiltonian for a small volume has, and translation invariant also. That has, like, you know, a gap, then if you continue, you can show that the gap remains open under some, like, small assumption on the on how you grow your system. But I guess this seems to be usually a natural assumption, you know, that people make when they try to prove these things. Anyone else has, like, an obvious answer to that?
Or spin one chain, Haldane spin chain.
Oh, yes, that's right, the Antiperm magnet.
Or Alexei's toric code.
That's correct.
Planar region.
Exactly. Yes, very good. The toric code. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. R, which is the diameter of the interaction, that appears in the hypothesis, but not in the computer.
Ah, very, very good. Okay, so you see it appears here, but this is not the important part. I was actually going to talk a little bit about this little guy right now, you know, because this is very important. This is called the Lib-Robinson velocity of your system, right? And this is exactly where this comes in. Specifically, so I haven't explained actually this mu or this v yet, right? But I think everything else is in there so far. And the 7/2 I haven't explained. Yes.
So L has nothing to do with R, so L?
No, L is something, let's say, larger than R. You will usually take this to be much larger than R, exactly. And what this says is that as this boundary becomes thicker and thicker, this approximation becomes better and better, right? If you have fixed, like, your range and your strength of interactions. This is something nice because it works, as we said, for any subset chi of your system. So what is this Lib-Robinson velocity here? I will just sketch a little bit what this looks like. Right, the next part. So V is kind of proportional, and I'm going to talk about, let's say, in Z2, okay, because in higher dimensions, you know, powers will change, but it looks something like this. Okay, so it looks like it is exponential in this parameter mu, it is like the cube of like the range, okay? And it is, and you multiply also with the strength of the interaction. So usually it looks something like that. And you can get these specifically from like what are called Lebromson bounds. And if you need like references for that, I can definitely give you some later. But this is like the velocity, you know, for let's say Z2. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, what is this
mu again? Yeah, very good. Okay. This mu is any parameter greater than zero. Okay. Can be anything greater than zero in this case. In this case, it's an optimization, right? You take it, but it becomes physical in what sense? That if it is something very large, it's going to destroy, like, you know, your correlation length, right? So you want it to really be, and I always kind of take it to be about the inverse of my intrinsic range of interactions, right? So at that point, this term kind of goes away, right? Just a constant, and you remain with something that looks more like, you know, really a velocity of interactions in two dimensions. It's spreading a certain range and also covers like R squared. So does this make more sense? So I didn't actually, I wanted to immediately like put it here as 1 over R, but I wanted also people to see that this is an optimizing parameter, even though you use it. That J is this J here. This is the strength, you know, how many interactions on every side you have like overlapping sets of interactions, right? What is the strength of like all of them? And you take the supremum over all of them. Yes. Yes.
The size of the boundary is something that increases exponentially with
the size of the boundary? No. The size of the boundary just actually L doesn't even have to do anything with it, little L, right? I mean, you know, in two dimensions, the size of the boundary would be like proportional to like big L. If like, you know, your system is L by L. Right? So you see what I mean? If like you have a system that is L by L, then anything in here, you know, that would be like the length of the boundary would not be exponential like in little L. It'd just be like something, some constant, convexity constant times L.
Would go up exponentially with the diameter of the interior?
With the diameter of the interior. It would go as like the diameter to n minus 1 if you're in Zn, right? I think like the radius of the ball. But this is okay. I mean, this is small stuff. First of all, we fix, you know, this is maybe exponential, but it's fixed in the sense that, you know, you have Z2, Z3, whatever it is. This exponential is the important one because this L can really, like, you know, go as the diameter, as you were saying. So it's much more powerful.
So,
go ahead.
Can you just briefly explain the dimension or the units of these parameters? Because that thing has unit length, because it's L over 2C, that is on the exponent.
Uh-huh.
What about the mu? V is a velocity, so what about the mu and the gamma and so on?
So this is a good question, but as far as the length goes, it would be kind of like a mess to try to, as you can see from here, you know, like, you know, what the units are can be a little bit confusing. But this is supposed to be just, the units of Xi are supposed to be the same as the units of L.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this L here. So this is like dimensionless quantity. And everything else, again, like, you know, is kind of absorbed in this constant here with respect to like units from here. But I guess intuitively what is important is that this is fixed. This is some correlation length, okay, that is of order like R times something, and depends also on this unit of, you know, energy, right, in this way. And I guess everything else is like kind of irrelevant. The exponential part says as L becomes larger and larger with respect to this C, the correlation length, you get much better approximation.
Is the L a real length, or is actually
You can take like you can take L to be like some linear distance in this dimension. So in one dimension, it would actually be the number of spins on left and right of a certain like inner spin. In higher dimensions, it would be, you know, this linear width of your boundary. It's getting the thickness. Sure. Yeah. Sorry, I don't feel I have answered your question again, like, but you're asking like what the units of this are.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, and it looks like gamma is a time.
Yeah, let me see here. Yes.
And it has to have a time scale. I mean, it has
yes,
to
I think you're.
Scale.
That's right. That's right. It is like mu is like time.
Mu
I can tell because mu is supposed. Maybe
mu is
it'll
one
be,
over r, so mu is one over length, and so gamma should be time. Because mu v is gamma.
We could have dropped r somewhere.
Well, okay, I see. I think you're asking like a very physical question. This is more like, I guess, mathematical statement. But maybe it'll make more sense once I write the Lib-Robinson bound, which this is coming from. So you'll see like, you know, where this mu is coming from, right, as a parameter. Because, again, in math, you just use it as an optimization parameter, right? But yes, it does have some units that, you know, makes more sense to you, I guess, if you think about the units. But mathematically, I don't know.
Yeah, so just do you have any intuition why the velocity bound should be r cubed rather than r?
Yes, I think the way it goes is that you have, like, say, in two dimensions, right?
Yeah.
You have a certain like linear expansion of your once you're evolving your system under some Hamiltonian, right? That is in two dimensions. It expands linearly with some velocity r, okay? But also, like, you know, its number of interactions you have are something like of the order r squared in there, because z has diameter r, right? So it's like, you know, at every point you have like r away, but like, you know, times r squared, so you get this r cubed. And the j really comes from like the bound, you know, that bound there.
Oh, are you doing this in two dimensions then?
This is just a particular like example, yes. So for you could see it, yes. Because in high dimensions it just gets, this gets larger and larger, so. But there is a, you know, there's kind of like a little bit of a complicated formula for this velocity v, but in most papers you don't even, you know, r is finite, you don't even, you just say it's a constant. But.
Sorry, why is this a velocity? I'm kind of.
Why is this a velocity? Let's go to that. Okay, let's go to that. That's a very good question. So this is the next part. All right. See, perfect. I think I designed this talk in such a way that, you know, you will want to stay to find out what I just wrote, right? I did that consciously, actually. So, all right, so it keeps in track, I guess, with what I have. We're going to write a few of the useful tools for a proof of something like that, which will also explain what this is more clearly. So, first one is like Lib-Robinson bounds. Okay, so let us assume that we have two observables, one in X, A and B, with different supports. Supports are actually such that is actually empty, and both of them are subsets of our V. Okay. So where does this velocity come from? Right. So now we have, and I think I can erase that here. So if we define, we set this tau sub t of like h to, this is going to be the evolution of the operator A with respect to this Hamiltonian that we have defined already. And actually in general, like, you know, this evolution can depend on different Hamiltonians. So you already have a notion of time right here, right? And then we have the following is true. If you take the norm of the commutator, like the evolution of this operator A that is far away from some other operator B, okay? What this Lib-Robinson bound tells you is that there is some velocity V for which that is actually also finite, for which this is true, times minimum of v of x, comma, y times, can I write it? Okay. E to the negative. That's where the mu, I guess, comes in. The distance between the two supports plus vt. Okay, so let me explain that a little bit, because this is important. All right. So what this says is the following. If you do have a Hamiltonian that satisfies this range and strength interaction, you know, assumptions, then this commutator, right, you see that originally A and B, if T is 0, this commutator is 0, right, because we assume that these supports are distinct. But as you turn on this evolution, immediately you have some, immediately, I mean, T is something very small, you have some overlap. But the question is, how much overlap do you have, right? And you want to quantify that. And the way you quantify that is, you say, okay, we take the norm of the commutator of this observable with some other one further away, distance x, y. Then the bound is exponentially decreasing in this distance, but there is also some velocity as time goes by, because, you know, this makes sense, right? You know, at some point it will overcome the distance as your interactions are spreading, right? And this velocity is the key part here that says, all right, there's some finite number, so it doesn't grow like infinitely. So no matter what you take this to be, you know, you have a trivial bound. Because of course you could just like upper bound this by 2 times the norm of this thing. Forget about this stuff, right? Just by trivial bound. Questions on that? No? All right. So that's where this mu comes in. This mu is this parameter, but again, even in some papers about Lie-Bronson bounds, they don't even tell you exactly how it relates to this velocity. So you think, ah, I could take this to be infinite. It's doing great, right? But no, it's this v actually depends in this way to mu. So it's like, you know, it's, you can make this large, but also this is going to be exponentially large. So you really want to keep it close to something 1 over length. But again, physically, I guess, this is distance. You can take it to be, I don't know what to say, but yeah. To me, I think of it as 1 over some length.
So it was mu again?
Yes, this mu is the same as this mu.
Okay, but what is this?
What's
that?
What was that?
This
mu is some parameter greater than 0 you can take to optimize this bound. And the only constraint you have is that the velocity v looks like this.
Oh.
Right? This is important. Yes. Otherwise, as I was saying, you can take this to be huge. Good? And that's why I was saying I usually just take it to be the effective like range of the interaction, so this term just goes away. This one here, right? Okay, I think we have enough so we can explain some of that. So what it says is this projection to the ground state, the unique ground state of the Hamiltonian with a gap, this explains this part here, okay, can be decomposed in, this is the supremum norm, right? This is, the supernorm is not the one norm. It would be wonderful if it was one norm, but, you know, what it says is there are 3 operators, 2 of which are projections, that are projecting onto non-overlapping sets, a set like chi that you're interested in, and a set outside of that, okay? And then there's something that is effectively entangling the two. It kind of makes sense. There is like some operator with norm less than or equal to 1 that is overlapping the two regions chi and chi complement with this like thickness 3L, okay? And this L is exactly the same as the one coming into this exponential decay here. So as you're expanding the boundary of overlap, effectively you're making this better and better of an approximation to this projection. And this is for any chi, for any subset, as long as it's some convex subset, I guess, so you can have some good bounds later on. Okay?
Is it kind of a picture where you have a larger and larger system than the entanglement or whatever language you use to describe the mixture between the different parts of the system becomes smaller?
Yeah, yeah. But again, unfortunately, this is not enough, you know, as far as we know right now, to prove area law, I guess. because the entropy has special, I guess, difficulties that go with it. Really, it does say a little bit that correlations between the inside and the outside decay, like, you know, really fast. Okay, so,
is it surprising that this is true, or is it surprising that it can be proved?
This, right, for any region. Well, you can tell me after I'm done proving it.
But
for me, it is not surprising that this is true. What is surprising to me is that this is not enough to show the area law. But again, if you go through Matt's paper on the one-dimensional area law, where he uses just the one-dimensional version of that, you can see actually why it's hard. Because there are regions of like this parameter L that are like, you're like, oh, come on, it has to work. Like, you know, I've already made such a great approximation, but it turns out like the problem is, I think it was like Jeff's like, you know, talk that he was saying, you know, things can go really badly if you have, you know, something that has a lot of like, you know, weight somewhere and like, you know, a lot of things with very small weight. It's exactly the same problem here. This may have like exponentially large and do actually have sometimes exponentially many projections within them, you know, rank one projections. So, so this is the first tool somewhere in there of things that I want to talk about. I guess I can erase a little bit over here, but I will try to keep the statement of the theorem up there the whole time. The second tool that has to do with just some operator that we create to try to initially approximate the ground state, because this is what we really want to do in the end, right? I mean, this is just preliminary stuff. So I'm going to call these 4-2 to go with the problems here. So we're going to introduce some parameter alpha. And we're going to create the following operator. And we have okay. Again, I could put like, you know, minus the energy of the ground state, but let's just assume that the ground state has zero energy. Okay. Everything just follows through. So why is this a good approximation to the ground state? Right. It has to do with the Fourier transform of the Gaussian and the fact that there is a spectral gap already. Right. Now, let's see why. Okay. For eigenvector, more mathematical. If we do the calculation of this, just this is another one, okay. So we're trying to show that the norm difference of these things is actually small, exponentially small in, you know, this parameter alpha somehow. So if we just do this, we get something like delta of mn. So the two have to be the same of, can you actually see some of this stuff from back there? I don't know. It's the Greek in me. I can't help it. Okay. Minus delta. Okay, so what does this say, right? I've just done the math. I haven't done anything like tricky here. Using this operator here, if you sandwich it between any two eigenvectors of your original Hamiltonian H sub B, right, you will just get like, you know, this energy up here, okay? You will also get this delta between the two because this in that basis, right? That's what you get if you decompose this. Should I write that down? No. Okay. And also, like, you know, from right here, you immediately would get this, which implies that really you want m equal to n, irrespective of what these things are. And also you want the other case, m equals to 0. So what you get is for m greater than or equal to 1. Actually, let me start with the m equals 0 case. What do you get for the m equals 0 case? You should get exactly, actually, this should be like e0 is 0. So you would get 1 minus 1 is equal to 0. Okay. So this would be, which is nice, because we, you know, we want it for all of them to be small. It's especially nice because the ground state, this is 0. And then for m greater than or equal to 1, what we have is that I am of this thing. I apologize for the math, but somebody has to do it. You can really see that. I'm impressed. e to the negative. Alpha, which is so everyone kind of sees that? This immediately appears from the Fourier transform of the Gaussian. Okay? So, and go from here to here, if m is equal to n, you can see right away, for m greater than 1, this is going to be 0. So what really remains is the Fourier transform of this Gaussian at this energy, which is this. Okay? And because this is greater than gamma, by assumption, we get this uniform upper bound. All right.
There should be some picture associated with this, right? This is somehow P0, I'm just trying to understand what P0 alpha is. It's some sort of averaging over some Gaussian?
Yes, if you were to go into the energy picture, like the Fourier transform, you know, of all this, what it does is it selects, like, the energies with this Gaussian, right, in the other, in the Fourier picture, that are less than gamma, okay, in the sense. But it doesn't really, it's just that for everything that is above gamma, if you choose like alpha to be small enough, then you can make this thing like really, really small. And maybe what I'm, I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's possible not to use like this Gaussian. You don't have to use this Gaussian, right? You can actually use some smooth bump function, as it's called, some cutoff function, that completely gives you like this is equal to P naught, okay? In the sense that in the energy picture, okay, if here is gamma, let's say here is negative gamma. You could, like, you know, choose something that has Fourier transform like at 0 equal to 1 and something that decays like this and is smooth enough, right? This is an approximation of this. As alpha becomes, like, you know, smaller and smaller, this becomes more and more defined in that way. But you could actually choose smooth bump functions that have exactly this property, where you have like truncation right before gamma, right? So nothing else of higher energy is picked up later on once you do this Fourier transform. So this would be equal to 0, actually. Like this would actually be equal to P naught in that case. You just have to choose the right functions. The reason why I'm using this Gaussian is because of these Libre-Ohmison bounds, as we will see later on. Because these other bump functions have this very nice property that they give you an exact approximation to the ground state. But then these tails here, the derivatives, like, you know, the way they go to 0 are not as nice as a Gaussian. And again, this has to do a little bit with Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that in both pictures, this seems to be like the minimizing function. So the reason why, again, you will see, I guess, a little bit later on why. So, yes.
Are you sure you want to do this in real time, not imaginary time?
This is in real time. Yes, this is real time. So does this make sense? Like, you know, the key step is right here. The Fourier transform of the Gaussian will still give you something small. But we again have this new parameter alpha that we can fine tune later on, right? Good. So the last tool that we're going to use is actually very similar to that one. And again, has to do with energy selection. And you will see a little bit more about it. So I guess I can erase this now. You can also think of this tool I'm going to write down as making something that is not frustration-free, frustration-free. So frustration-freeness means that, like, if you have a Hamiltonian, it is a sum of certain interactions, this phi of z. Frustration-free Hamiltonian will be one that has these interactions being positive, and for each one of them, the ground state of the global system is actually still a ground state. So that would be frustration-free. But it's a very nice way, I guess, Kitaev, I think, was the first one to start developing this, and then Osborne and Hastings, to give some new ways of constructing frustration-free Hamiltonians out of, like, ones that are just general. You know, they have a gap, actually, and local, but that's it. So let's see. We have some operator A, like this, for some, like, subset of V. And what we define is A of alpha, kind of like before, but not exactly. So we have, again, we're going to hit it with this Gaussian. But now we're going to hit its evolution under the Hamiltonian with this Gaussian. Okay. I could subtract also the expectation of this operator on the ground state, but let's assume that this is already done. Right? Every time I write an operator, we're going to do that. So why is this a nice operator? What are the properties? OK, let's see here. We have, I think those are nice tricks for, I guess, everyone here to use when they want to understand better, like, you know, what is possible with, or what assumptions really they need to make for their Hamiltonians when they work with them. But in this case, we have that we're going to try to show that the eigenvector psi naught of the global ground state, right, is going to be almost an eigenvector for this operator. So this is what we're going for. First of all, we have this. And why do we have this? Because the expectation of this is really the expectation of this thing here. And as we assume, like, the expectation of A at psi naught is 0. So this is going to be 0, right? This is just a normalization, right? If you were to take away the whole thing, this would be equal to 1 because we normalize the Gaussian. But do you see what I mean? Right? This thing, if you put, like, psi naught or anything really of that form, this is just equal to, okay? Because psi naught is an eigenvector of H. And in general, you would have, I guess, maybe I'll just write it later on. We have some other eigenvector. We get this and e to it. Exactly. Okay. Assuming again that e naught is 0, right? I mean, otherwise it just follows. Okay. So this implies the following. Same thing as before. dt, and then we also have, as I was saying, this part right here, okay? So this is equal to this, right? This is nice because, again, we use a Fourier transform to get e to the negative dm squared alpha. So why is this good so far? Because if we really want to find the norm of this vector, okay, let me just write it up here. If we just want the norm of this vector, okay, we want to bound this. This is just equal to the sum over sine r a alpha greater than or equal to 0, right? But really, we can start from 1 since at 0 it's 0. So this is going to be, again, here, less than or equal to. Again, we can substitute, like, after we put things together, what we will get is the sum, m greater than or equal to 1, of e to the negative em squared over 2a, because we have two of them. And then, I know, a, then the rest is done the moment that you replace this. This is positive. So you replace this with e to the negative gamma squared over 2a. And you sum again like this identity in here to get. Okay? There is actually in between these two a's 1 minus p naught, but whatever. I mean, it doesn't make. The difference is, well, you can think of this as just squared. So taking the square root on both sides is going to give you, again, something like that multiplied with, you know, the norm of that. So that's pretty nice, I think, because, again, you get something that is, like, exponentially small if you take alpha to be really small. So. Effectively, you made this an eigenvector of this new operator, okay? And this operator A can be as small as you want. It could be actually just like one of your phi of z's, right? Just as one side or two side operator. But there's a catch, right? There's always a catch. I mean, these operators are no longer local. If A was local somehow, I mean, you've turned on the evolution, right? Exactly because of this part right here. Okay, so it spreads. And this is exactly why we use the Lie-Bromson bounds, okay, because we can effectively make it local again, or as local as we want, as these, like, you know, length scales get bigger and bigger. So that's why, you know, we have this fight in between, okay, how, like, small do you want to make, you know, your operator, its support, and how good do you want the approximation, and this is exactly where this alpha is determined in the end. Otherwise, you could just take it to be really, really small. So let's see now.
Sorry, might think of getting away. This is a nice operation.
Ah, yes. So this is a nice operation because you have made effectively this operator A, right, that originally would have, like, this kind of, you know, norm, I guess, at psi naught. Okay, so psi naught would not be an eigenvector with eigenvalue close to 0 of A. Just you don't know what even A is, right? I mean, it's just some operator. But with this transformation, you've made it so that this is actually bounded by something very small. The norm that you were supposed to have times something that you can make really small. In this, okay. I guess you will see, like, later on in the proof why we want something like that. But But often, I guess you want to, it's much easier to work with something that is frustration-free, as many will tell you. You know, then that you know that your ground state satisfies every constraint individually instead of just in the global sense, right? And this is an operation that helps you with that. Yes, exactly. Your constraint is smeared out, so it becomes bigger, has bigger support, right? But again, it is satisfied by the global ground state much closer, right? Before you had no idea what kind of, like, you know, whether we're satisfied or not, now it does. And the question is, how delocalized does it become? And this is where the Lieber-Ohmson bounds come in to tell you that you can kind of, like, you know, truncate the dynamics and still have a good approximation. So, but let's see. The funny thing is that I am actually about to start the proof now. So, you can go get some water if you want. Let's see, we have, it's already been an hour, hasn't it, huh? Let's take a break because I also we did start a little bit late.
Just before you erase that, alpha is very large, corresponds to one of steering, or small?
If alpha is small, then it corresponds, because it's one over the deviation, you can think of it, one over square root of the deviation. Like of your Gaussian deviation. That's right. So you want it to be small, alpha, for this to be large. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it will come in later on, as we will see. Oh, you mean this one here? Yeah, so...
You agree that it's exponential in the diameter of the interior, right?
Yes, but it's exponential in the sense of, like, if the diameter is d, right, it's at most d to the n minus 1 times some constant, right?
N is large.
No, n is fixed. It could be 1, 2, 3, I mean, it's z to the n, right?
It's not exponential.
Exactly, I mean, what I mean is it's a power, that's right. Exponential in the... You know, it's d to the n minus 1.
So my feeling for this picture comes from the Hamming.
Okay.
If you look at the, let's say, the center is the n bit string, which is not 0.
Ah. Oh, no, it's different here. Yeah, here it's different. This would be one of the sides of your string, right? The center would actually be just like one side x in your v. So you can think of like v as just being the two-dimensional lattice, right? In two dimensions, in three dimensions would be the cubic lattice. So this really would just be a collection of sites within a region, chi, and outside.
So it's really something like L2 power.
Exactly, it's like a ball, you know, the volume of the ball. So actually, it's the surface area. It was good because I confused Frederick too with this picture before I explained more.
In terms of removing frustration, if you started with a frustration...
Frustration-free, nothing would happen.
Yeah,
go ahead, yes.
So if you start with a frustrated Hamiltonian...
Ah, yes.
You apply this construction to each of the terms, and you can make each of the terms arbitrarily close to...
Zero.
Which has the ground state.
Yes.
And because if you apply the same construction to the projector onto the ground state, you don't screw up the ground state. So in other words, the deformed Hamiltonian has the same
thing. Yes, even though remember that it wasn't exactly, we didn't use like some type of evolution, right? It was just a one-sided thing. But yes, you're right. That is the case. Yeah, that's why the previous construction worked for the ground state nicely. And this is what we will use. Very good. I don't know if this is whoever remained or not.
No.
Because he's coming back, but I guess I can.
We're doing this timeline.
Yeah, it is an hour since I started. So.
I don't think that
No, it wouldn't be. No. I don't think I can stay for more than like the time anyway. So.
So how do you want to do it?
I guess the time includes questions, and I think we've had already a bunch of questions. But if you want to stay for another 10 minutes, I can sketch like the rest of the proof, and you can see how this tool's coming. If you want to see like a better idea of how you get these, right? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the proof has the following, I think, 7 steps, but I will just, stay. They're simple steps. That's right. Any step doesn't take more than a page. Good luck. Yes, it's nice that you have the notes, so you can just read them if you want, but I'll just go over them quickly. So the idea is first you split your Hamiltonian into 3 parts, okay? It is like the X interior, which is given by this part, the X boundary, which is given by this exactly with length L, and then exterior, which is just the outside part, right? Now, why do you do that? So what we do is we apply the following transformation, this transformation alpha, frustration freeness, right, to the original Hamiltonian, which will not change it at all. Okay, the reason is because it's evolving under itself. So it just commutes through and nothing happens, right, when you do the stuff here. Anyways, but also we have linearity, which means that each one of them is going to be hit by this transformation. So we might as well just write the alphas right here. Okay? Boundary and boundary terms. Okay, so this is exactly what, exactly. So very good point. Oh, it's actually pretty perceptive. So it's really like we're missing also some interactions when we write it this way, but yeah, we include them in this part and in this part, right? The ones that cross the boundary. Okay. Okay, so. Oh, okay, I guess I just went through. Well, it appears on the left as well, but you see because this is equal to this, right, the alpha operation applied to H sub V will not change it, right, because remember it evolves, it has this evolution under H sub V, so this is going to commute through, right? Exactly, and the rest is just one, it's a constant, so. Okay, so we have this so far, so we're kind of getting there. All right, now, this is one page. No, the interior of X is this. Chi is when you include this thickness out here. Right. Same thing with the exterior, it's missing something. Alright, so now we're going to use Lie-Bronson bounds to localize each one of these, right? And what we're going to write them as is like we're going to say, okay, we define this new operator that looks like this, and I will only do it for one of them. And just sketch why this is the case. Right, have x the chi of x interior V. Okay, so I'll just do it for this, but we do it for this one as well, just to replace this with this. Why is this close to this operator? Okay, now this operator is the same, but instead of chi, we have V here, right? Evolution under the whole Hamiltonian, if you remember. Right. The Lie-Bronson bounds though tell you that you have this operator here that is L away from the boundary. Its support is in here. That's why we chose it to be a thickness inside of L. Right? And if you evolve it with respect to this Hamiltonian, it's really like it doesn't see that it's being evolved with this instead of like H sub V. Right? Because for the time it takes to reach here, this is good enough for us. Right? So you get actually the kind of bound that you want, which is I'm gonna skip like some steps, unfortunately, but that's okay. Some constant, this one, L to the 3/2, so you see where these things come in. Okay. So you get something like that. Now how do you get that again? Like quickly what you do is you split like, you know, this integral for times less than some t naught, for which you have good Lie-Bronson bounds, and then for times greater than that t naught, which you choose optimally, for which the Gaussian gives you like, you know, the decay that you want, and then you just use the trivial bound for this, and then you match up, and this is what you get. Okay, that was quick. So, what else do we have here? We also have the following nice bound.
So in terms like L 3/2 that comes out of the optimization.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, exactly. So, all right. So then we also have that this operator is close to the other one, is localized, actually, as you can see, exactly within this, like, you know, region chi now, right? And you can do the same thing with M chi complement for this operator. It's going to be another operator with support on the outside and no overlap with this one. You see why, right? Because this one is already contained and it's only evolving with something that is non-trivial on chi. So the support is chi. That's important. Yes? Right? This cannot go outside this evolution. Non-trivial, right? So, okay. So we also have this bound here. Like e to the negative xc. So again, this is like, this is of the order of this. And how do we get this? We use this bound, right, with the triangle inequality to insert this operator in here, right? And then we use this bound for that part. And then when you apply psi naught to this one, we've already shown that it's actually close to an eigenvector, which gives us this part, okay? So at this point, we have like, we want something like, when I choose 1 over L to be our alpha, this particular like case, right? So they match up. Okay, that's actually, we're cooking with gas. That's good. One of my favorite professors used to say that. Greg Cooperberg, anywhere you are. All right. So, okay. So we've done all that, but why? Because when we go back to, like, this, when we go back to this guy here, this projection we had written, right? It'd be amazing if I can do this in time. E to the I, T, A to the negative this thing. Remember, we used this one and had a good, like, you know, overlap with the actual ground state. Then if we change this in the following way, we, what do we do? Say that, I'm going to make this a 1 here. We add and subtract the following operator. Boundary, okay, and then e to the I t m x alpha. Did I actually write that? I did. And there is also in here. So, what have we done? Okay, we've inserted something and then it's complement, but not exactly. Okay, not exactly. If this was like equal to the sum of this and this, then it would really be the identity. Okay, but it's not. It's close though. Okay, we already know that the sum of the two terms that are really implicit in here are really close to the sum of these two terms, and it's very easy, like, to show that if you differentiate this expression to show that this is really close to the identity. Okay, it's not difficult. So, but why do we do that? We do that because now you see the supports of these operators are distinct. So really, this is like a product of these exponentials. Okay, and what we will do is we will actually choose, and you get to see where this comes from. These projections, p sub x and p sub x complement, to be projections onto eigenvalue or eigenspace, I guess, eigenspace of mx and m chi complement, respectively, with eigenvalues less than or equal to delta, some delta which we actually take to be L to the 3/2 e to the negative L over 2c. Okay, some really small, like, you know, thing. Just to give you an intuition, if these things were already frustration-free, that would actually be containing only the ground state, because if you have a gap, then this is too small for the gap, right? So it would really be the ground state there. But we just include, like, you know, these projections that are independent of each other, right? Now, why do we do that? Because this gives us the following bound, say, just for one of them. If you project outside of these, d sub chi is like, sorry, it's supposed to be here, projection onto. No, the projections are, these are the projections onto the eigenvectors or eigenspaces with eigenvalues less than this very small, like, you know, value. We know that there is something already that satisfies it because of this bound here. That's a sign not to be in there. Okay. And a bunch of other stuff. We don't know how many. Okay, so, but we have this actual thing here, this actual observation, 1 over delta n sub chi of psi naught, which is less than or equal to this k dx e to the negative l over 2c. So quickly, let me explain why this is the case. So we have from here, right, that you can take this to be about e l to the 3/2 from before e to the negative l over c. So if you divide with something that is of this order, you should get something, you know, of this order.
So let me just ask, suppose you did the more naive thing and you just took p sub chi to be the projection onto the eigenspaces of just the terms of the Hamiltonian from the chi side.
So everything, you mean? Like, okay.
You don't do the smearing.
Yeah.
You just break the Hamiltonian.
You cannot then do anything with respect to this. You cannot get this bound, which is important, right? Because you already need to have some smearing in order for this to be small enough. So when you divide with something that's smaller, you still get something small, right? Otherwise, it would be h sub chi. You don't really know what this is, right? You know, that's the whole point of the frustration-free smearing. You want, like, when you restrict to a certain, some random volume you've chosen chi, that in that volume, this is going to be close to an eigenvector.
So roughly, the smearing reduces frustration.
Exactly. It reduces frustration. So you can consider each part, whatever part you want of your Hamiltonian, to be acting as something that is, like, has very few frustrations with respect to the ground state. Yes. Okay? So this is, I guess, kind of a key point here.
That's this smearing, right? Not all the
smearing. Yeah. No, this is the smearing that comes with this. There's supposed to be an alpha here, right? So these were defined right there, okay? So, and the reason why this is the case is because this operator squared as an operator is greater than or equal to delta squared times this, okay? Just because we chose this to be a projection onto stuff below, right? Anyways, you can see that in the notes. We don't have much time. All right, so because of that, what happens when we actually take this operator and we project actually this and this onto it, okay? It's going to select just the same type of like impact. So let me go here and do that. This is going to be 3 something 4. So we're getting there. You can see why. Because if you do P naught 1 of alpha of peak high, I complement minus P naught. So the second, what you get is the following. The norm difference of this thing is less than or equal to P naught. Plus this other estimate. Sorry, okay, here. Right. Now, this one is going to be small because we originally said that this is going to be small, okay? We've shown that it's here already. And this is small because exactly of these estimates here, okay? Because you can split like this product into something that is less than or equal to P naught 1 minus x plus. There's some term missing with norm 2, but you know, this doesn't matter. This is exactly why we needed to do this whole smearing all this time. It's right this step right here. Okay? So this could be small. So we could multiply this operator with these things and be like, okay, we haven't lost anything so far, right? But because this operator has this particular form where these projections are really projections onto eigenspaces of these two things, it's really like we're eliminating up to a small error this operator altogether, okay? This is going to go away. And you could just do, you know, again, fundamental theorem of calculus to show you why this is actually small, you know? So what I'm trying to say is substituting this here with just this only carries a penalty that is about 2 times delta times the time it takes. Okay, you can show that. So this is good because we're almost there right now. We just have to consider this operator. Forget about that, this operator dt. Okay, and this is going to be this operator here. But as you can see right now, it's we don't know what kind of like localization the operator has. Okay, it just looks weird. But it is actually pretty nice, nicely behaving operator. And let me show you now why. Because I'm gonna switch to white again. If you were to take the partial with respect to time of, you know, of this thing here minus h boundary alpha, then what you would get is something like e to the I hv evaluated at t, that is h boundary alpha e to the negative I t hv, and then the whole operator u of t again, where I have called like this whole thing here, this is u of t. So this is just gives you like an idea of what the generator of this unitary looks like. This is a unitary, right? And this is nice because if you can localize the generator, you localize effectively, you know, the whole operator, right? If you can say the generator has non-trivial support on like this part, then you're done, okay? But again, we use 2 Lie-Bromanson bounds. The first one is, this already is spreading, okay? This is spreading, but you can substitute this with this operator, like the 2L, okay? Up to very small error, which is something I didn't go into. So it's going to give you a very small difference in the generators, which is good enough, you know, when you're doing your calculations. So this is going to spread only up to 2L. And then this outside evolution, again, you use a second Lebesgue-Robinson estimate, and you cut it down to x of your boundary up to 3L. With, again, a very small error depending on the x or L width that you have, and you're done. That's it. I mean, this is exactly what this operator is, right? It's if you were, like, to put this generator for this U of T in here, because it was really, like, this unitary we were working with, and this is localized and satisfies all the bounds we wanted. You see, you have to use these Lebesgue-Robinson bounds all the time, but, you know, you don't care if it is 2L or 3L in the end or whatever, but this is how questions now I'm done. So. Sorry, I had to go kind of fast in the end because this is, you know.
So can you give sort of a succinct summary of the philosophy? It's roughly, mm-hmm. You cut into these three pieces, you take the three bits of the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And projecting their low states, those are the three projected roughly, but that's not quite right.
That's right.
Of the frustration, so you attack the frustration with these evolutions.
And smearing.
Mm-hmm. Measure the effect using the Robinson.
What you do is when you smear these. Okay, yeah. So when you smear them, right, you actually have shown through these Fourier transforms that you do have small, like, you know, small norm at the ground state for each one of these right parts, which is important for these, you know, parts right here. But again, you're losing locality when you do that because you are evolving with respect to the whole Hamiltonian, right? You need, like, you know, the whole Hamiltonian so you can say something when you hit it with the eigenstates, right? But you can effectively localize each one of them. Why? Because you use Lebesgue-Robinson bounds to say, okay, whether I have evolved this region here with respect to, like, this Hamiltonian, right, it has to have bigger thickness, right, than your original region. Or whether I have included not just this part, but also the rest, it will not be seen up to a certain time, like, you know, that scales with this L. This is how you get this exponential, like, you know, bounds in L, right? And you keep doing that. You're saying again, then once you're here, if I were to increase this, you know, thickness here, it doesn't matter where you evolve with the whole thing or with just the extra increase.
So the smearing doesn't really make the pieces commute with each other.
No.
It makes them sort of commute on the ground state.
Exactly. On the ground space of the ground state, they commute, okay. But not on the whole. That's the whole point of the Lebesgue-Robinson bounds.
So if you started a global ground state,
yes.
You could magically cut out some convex
sure.
region.
Yeah.
So you just the Hamiltonian suddenly zero in there, and uh-huh. So it's effectively like it doesn't exist anymore. Then you don't excite much energy outside that region. In other words, because you've got this projector mm-hmm. onto very low eigen. Low energy
stays within and outside, you mean?
Uh-huh. In the exterior region.
Okay.
If you could suddenly do that, you wouldn't excite much energy outside the region. And vice versa, mm-hmm. if you mm-hmm. cut out the exterior, you wouldn't excite mm-hmm. much energy. Presumably
that's
because of this gap. Because of the gap.
You have the gap, you can do the smearing.
Local, mm-hmm. Because of the gap in the locality. In there.
Exactly. You need both. The gap gives you the smearing,
yeah.
And the locality gives you the Lebesgue-Robinson bounds. So after you've smeared, you haven't destroyed everything because, you know, you can still localize things because you need commutation in order to get some nice bounds.
So you can just sort of look at the one region in mind and say, okay, well, not much energy here, not much energy here, not much energy in between.
Something like that.
If I choose on the theorem, I would say I take a piece of superconductor, cut it in half. That half is still in the ground state superconductor.
But it's not, yeah, because when you cut it in half, right, this theorem would just simply not work if you didn't have this gluing operator right here, right? It just wouldn't work. I mean, you need like, you know, this one. Otherwise, you would just say that everything is a product state. Every ground state is gapped. It's just a product. That'd be wonderful. But, you know, you don't have that, right? That'd be also weird. Yeah, exactly. So it just, this is a very general theorem. That's why this is as much as you can say. But I guess this is enough, right? But you have this non-entanglement here, okay? You have no entanglement. If you have to hit this operator, which is close to this P naught, as Matt does, you know, with some trial state that you hope to boost up, like it's, you know, it's overlap with P naught, this would produce no entanglement. The Smith decomposition between these two, like, you know, regions, this remain like, kind of like the Smith number would remain the same, because those are like, is a product state of this. It's this one here that gives you all the extra entanglement, okay? Which makes this a realistic picture in the first place, so.
So at the beginning of your lecture, you cautioned us against a degenerate ground state. Of course, there's a very interesting case, topological cases.
Tori code, for example, yeah.
Degenerate ground state.
Yeah.
It seems to me the proof should work.
This is a very good point. I think that the proof would work, but the only problem is that, you know, you just have to think about how you're going to select one of them, you know? I guess you could say that for any one of them.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, yeah, I guess it would go through. That's right.
But a small perturbation of that gives you something that doesn't have a gap at all. It depends on the gap, right?
Well, we don't know that about the Tori code. Yes. But it doesn't even matter in this case. In this case, it doesn't matter because we don't have like any perturbations, right? We assume that for every like 8 sub v, you have this gap. Okay.
No, but what I'm saying, okay, so I'm not quite sure what I'm saying.
Okay.
But insofar as we talk about a gap being the separation between the lowest eigenvector
and the highest, yeah. And then second, yeah.
If you're going to make the ground state non-degenerate, to me that seems like you're saying now you have a zero gap in the total.
No, but I guess.
Sorry, in the degenerate case, that's you move the gap to zero because you get.
Right. But then what people speak of is the gap above the degenerate ground state.
That's right. Yeah.
That's what plays the
role. Exactly, because.
I understand that, but I'm confused as to why you can't turn this into a system with very, very small perturbation by pumping one of those ground state pieces to be a very tiny gap.
Oh, well, yeah. That does happen. I mean, if you preserve like the Tori code, you'll get an exponentially fine splitting of the ground states. And then there'll still be a gap above these four states which have an exponentially small splitting between them.
So the
that's what happens when you
So Jeff is saying, like, how come this can go through in this case if, like, this depends on this gamma being, like, some...
Well, you don't use the gamma to separate between the ground states.
That's right. The low energy to the high energy.
Morally, the ground states from the ones that are really exciting.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, even the definition of a topological... I mean, the definition of a topological phase is essentially that there's a stable degeneracy, which actually can't be removed from local perturbation. When people say that, they're... implicitly making an exception for exponentially small splittings of degeneracy. There's nothing to do about that.
So the generalization of this theorem would be instead of you, P0 would be a projection onto very low eigenvector states or something.
Onto all of them, I see, yeah. But
then
the question is how do you use that, I guess, to for each one of them to say that it has small entropy between two relative regions? Because I don't know how you can still go in there and choose, like, you know, one of the however many there are.
To extend the one-dimensional result?
Yeah, exactly.
Currently,
this is not enough to extend it.
But you were asking for this result, or were you asking for this?
No.
Yeah, for this. I'm just saying that, yeah, after the motivation behind this one was exactly when you have a unique ground state and you want to just choose that and say, what can I do to, you know. That's right, exactly. I mean, the whole thing would just go through, that's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point.
So, I'm not quite how to formulate this question, but
the area.
There's some sort of continuous analysis that sort of is done from a discrete problem. And is that done because these are the tools that people are used to thinking about? Or is that, I mean, is there, you know, for from certain perspectives, it is very unnatural to start continuitizing this discrete column with a gap and mm-hmm. these finite pieces. And
it's all done because of energy. Energy is not discrete, as far as I can tell. You know, it is discrete in a sense because you have like a gap, but like everything else is, you can just.
But even this, yeah. even the spectrums of what you're talking about are discrete.
They don't have to be, even though in this case you have a gap. So yes, in that lowest, you know, energy states, you do have like this discreteness. But as I was saying, I guess you can. It seems like when you're doing Lib-Robinson bounds, right, you need to have this kind of like more continuous time, right, to say like my system is evolving right now under this continuous time. And it's interesting how it ties in with the Fourier picture, you know, where you go into the energy landscape, you choose your ground state, separate from all the other ones, and then you localize this projector by using this technique.
Right, so I guess maybe what I'm asking is, okay, so
discretize.
The main thrust of this tool is the Lib-Robinson map, which yeah. is somehow it does something, it sort of continuizes something to get mm-hmm. what you want. And is that fundamental, or is that just sort of the easiest way to do it? Or
you mean,
doesn't seem very natural to me as a
how else could you think? I mean, this is a good, you know, you have a good point, but how else could you think of localizing, you know, the these operators that we're talking about? We have, you know, you go into the energy landscape and then you need these Fourier transforms to get there, and they're continuous, I guess, as far as I can tell in this case. So it's natural to use like this picture because evolutions are continuous with respect to some time.
Okay, maybe just that step to say evolutions are continuous. I mean, the original problem doesn't have any evolution in it, right? I mean,
that's right, yes.
It's just a static question about the Hamiltonian.
Very good, yeah.
So when you, like, is that I can understand sort of the physics, mm-hmm. some sense of the physics intuition of yeah. looking at evolution under this Hamiltonian.
It is not. So as far as the Lib-Robinson bounds go, they do kind of like make the analysis a lot easier once you have this continuous variable t, right? Which could be a flux, it could be time, it could be like potatoes, whatever, right? As long as they work, you know, for you. Because you need to do this analysis using the fundamental theorem of calculus, this generator of the evolution, where, you know, every time you take commutators of your Hamiltonian and only the terms of your local Hamiltonian survive in the commutator with your, like, you know, whatever your observable A, local observable A is, because everything else outside of it does not commute. I mean, it commutes through. So that's, but I guess you could make it discrete. It just, I don't know why. I mean, in my case, like, you know, it seems it's much easier because this one set of tools just combined gives you a lot of power. I don't see.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether they're fundamental. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, at some point,
you may not have,
when
yeah.
you first delve into this, it doesn't seem like
the way to go.
From some perspective, it doesn't seem like a natural way. Mm-hmm. It seems sort of like a mystery. And so now I'm trying to understand whether that is.
The question is, how would you choose? This is the original question in my mind. How do you choose the ground state? You have a Hamiltonian with a gap. How do you choose that? You know, using the Hamiltonian, because you cannot say, oh, here's my ground state, you know? You don't know anything about it. You have no information. All you know is that you have some Hamiltonian, and this internal structure of the Hamiltonian should tell you something about the ground state, assuming it has a gap. The only thing I can think of is you go into the energy picture, you know, using, like, these operators, and then you say, okay, I hit it with something whose Fourier transform, like, truncates things outside of this energy, and voila, I have something that has some, like, you know, Gaussian in it, and then something that has a Hamiltonian.
Well, but I mean, okay, I mean, if you just wanted to naively do that, you could do that with the spectrum. You could think of it as discrete and then do some serious approximation to something that cuts things down. I mean,
yeah, you could, but then you would have some discrete operator, you know, that tries to truncate stuff, and it would be probably a mess to try to analyze what happens with locality. Because you could have discrete Lib-Robinson bounds, but it seems much easier, you know, to go into the continuous picture. You lose nothing, as far as I can tell, but you're wondering about the intuition. So the intuition seems okay to me.
Exactly.
I see, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're wondering about time. Where does time come in?
Basically. Yeah, so continuity. Yeah. I think
is that if for some reason it's natural to start these exponentials that you're operating, then you might as well admit all the physical intuition that exists about real and imaginary time evolution. Mm-hmm. So in other words, every time you see a formula with the operator of the exponent, you're really thinking about time evolution. Is that the answer? I mean, if you didn't have any exponents in this,
there'd be no time.
Then you wouldn't have, then you'd be kind of in a time free, and then you probably would not be plugged into the physics intuition. There might be some combinatorial argument. But if the mathematics has exponentials of operators.
So maybe my question was, why is the mathematics of the exponential?
Because of the energy. The energy has to come in somehow, right? And time is inversely proportional to the energy, as you know, you think of it that way. So you have to create something that has like time times like their conjugate quantities. You try to find a way to isolate the ground state. You need something that picks out the energy. To do that, you need to go to the Fourier picture, and that's why you smear it with respect to some time variable. This is the only reason, right? This is just some fake time here that takes you to the other picture.
That's what I understood.
Yeah.
It's the original jump, which you guys definitely seem to think is natural.
I'm not so sure why there can't be a proof without it. The hypothesis has to do with the spectrum, right? And then when you exponentiate, of course, the spectrum behaves very well. It just gets exponentiated. So it seems to.
Yeah. And so would any other function?
What? No.
Functional calculus, you could.
Oh, yeah, you could create something else, yes. Yeah. You could hit it with a different type of function, and it doesn't have to be e to the I something. It could be a different transform. It could be Laplace, I guess, or whatever. But this just seems to be, because you know so much about the Gaussian, to be honest, in both into original form and the other, the Fourier space, this becomes like very, very nice to work with. And also, because you have like the Lie-Bronson bounds, right, which use really evolutions, which come in because you exponentiate stuff, like double whammy, why do you want to miss having, you see how well they were playing with each other, right? I mean, if you do something discrete, it's going to become very painful to try to localize what you just messed up, right? So.
Maybe,
okay.
You swear it or do something polynomial with it that's not so hard to keep track of.
But if you square it, how do you, what have you done? I mean, have you chosen the energy?
Change what the spectrum looks like.
Yes.
Maybe take one minus.
One over, okay.
Or one over.
Mm-hmm. Those are very good points. But right now I'm so used to these techniques that it's heresy to try to use it. it is at the point where I think when I was at your talk, like, it was so interesting to me what you were doing because it was discrete, right? And also because it had the finite set of these projections and it gave you this nice data that you could use. And I guess this is what, in my opinion, is missing from proving the area law for like general systems that satisfy these conditions. Some assumption like that, it is actually natural, but it gives you this intrinsic variable that we don't have yet. You know, we're missing, like, I feel we're missing a part to make the whole thing work, and it would be something like this. That's why I think we should talk. Yes. Anyways, the talk that you did miss today, which I was going to talk about, the plug for maybe some other week, has to do with something I started working with about a year ago with Matt Hastings, and it has to do with the quantum Hall effect and the quantization, the integer quantization. I think it would be interesting for some of you here, because this, he told me to go to Eisenman's webpage in Princeton and see, it was number 3, that is an open problem to show the quantization for interacting electrons and no averaging assumption, which means something to people who know about it. And we've been able to do that, again, using many of these ideas and some new theory we've developed along the way called quasi-adiabatic continuation. So I think, if you didn't get enough of this, you should But yeah, then you can actually show, quantization for real interacting electron systems with, all the good stuff. So, anyways, I think, good?
Okay, thanks again.